Welcome to the Banker Exchange, our weekly sit-down about what is happening now, what the industry is chatting about, and what bankers like you need to know. Hello and welcome everyone to the Banker Exchange, a podcast from The Banker. I am Liz Lumley and joining me today is Amalia Ilgener. Hello.
Hello.
Excellent. So some of you noticed that we were off on holiday last week for the Easter break. I hope you didn't miss us, but it was a great chance to catch up on past episodes, which I recommend everyone do. But we are back this week, and everyone knows the Banker Exchange is our weekly sit-down about newsy bits that influence current and future stories on thebanker.com. So today we are joined by an old friend, Keith Baer, fellow Cambridge Centre for Alternative Finance. Hello, Keith. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me, Liz, and Mina.
Excellent. So we are, of course, going to talk a little bit about digital assets, crypto, central bank digital currencies. And our current topic this week is kind of inspired by the announcement last week by the Bank for International Settlements, which announced, along with seven central banks, a project called Project Agora. And it's also going to join forces with the private sector, and it's going to explore how tokenization can enhance the functioning of the monetary system. That's a direct quote from the BIS Innovation Hub. The project builds on the unified ledger concept proposed by the BIS. We're going to get into that further on in the podcast. What I found interesting were a few things. We also ran a story the same week about SWIFT announcing the second phase of its industry-wide sandbox testing on its central bank digital currency interlinking solution for cross-border payments. So I found this kind of interesting, you know, taking into account several statements made by Hong Sung Shin, which is the BIS economic advisor and head of research, where I thought was kind of a direct, maybe attack is the wrong word, a front to SWIFT. And I don't think I'm alone. I was speaking to Naveen Malella, who is a managing director of JP Morgan Coin or Onyx Coin Systems this week. And he kind of said he thought SWIFT should be worried by the Project Agora BIS announcement as well. And Keith, you were quoted in the story, which is on the website, which influenced, inspired a LinkedIn poll that we put together because I wanted to see whether or not other people agreed with me that this was a bit of a affront to SWIFT. And it was, we're in the midst of a new global cross-border payments race. Who will win in the end? Will it be the global central banks? So 33% said yes. Commercial banks and stable coins, only 13% said this. But then we had two questions saying, whatever happens, SWIFT will definitely still be around. 40% said yes to this. I think they're a huge super tanker that may be hard to sink. But about 13% said SWIFT will be gone. So, Keith, one of the big questions we wanted to bring you on this podcast to ask, if you worked at SWIFT, would you be sleeping soundly in the midst of all this payments race?
I mean, good question, obviously. I mean, I think any participant in global payments to an extent can't be sleeping too soundly at the moment in the context that the rate of technology-enabled change, you know, be it blockchain or quantum or AI or whatever, is moving at such a pace that it's causing all of us, I think, to not, you know, rest on our laurels in terms of what has worked well in the past, which SWIFT obviously has done, but recognizing that things are changing, enabled by technology, but also new ideas, new business models, et cetera. And in particular, in this kind of context, the benefit that more decentralized models may have compared to more centralized approaches. So that's having impact across the board, I think. So as I said, I don't think anyone can sleep completely soundly because be it public or private sector, there is so much activity going on at the moment. It's really creating new opportunities and risks for everybody.
I mean, I was talking with Amelia about this before the podcast, and we'll get to some of her questions in a second. But I thought it was, you know, SWIFT is a, you know, over 40 years old. It's a massive global membership organization. I don't think it's something that's easily killed even by emerging technology. However, it does seem like even though, you know, speaking to JP Morgan, they said they thought SWIFT would be worried. It does seem like the banks are kind of you know, playing the everyone game, putting their fingers in the pies for every member of this payments race, you know, kind of like a billionaire donating to all the politicians to see who wins in the end. Do you think we might be entering an age of coexistence? And do you think what issues would arise if we're in this era of coexistence?
Because of the, you know, variety and there are different kind of propositions that are out there at the moment in both the public and the private sectors, inevitably will kind of lead to this age of coexistence, as you say. I mean, on the positive side, that does mean there's going to be more choice and more competition, and that can only, I assume, be a good thing for participants and for, you know, participants in the payment network, etc. But it also leads to some potential issues and risks. For example, I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about so far has been on the regulated side of digital money. But obviously, we have a whole set of stable coins that are currently unregulated. So what role will they play as far as the future payments landscape is concerned? And there's also the question, I think, on the possible impact of fragmentation. So that if we have, you know, coexistence, as you say, and we have central bank oriented options, which are more CBDC based, and we have commercial bank money options, which are more tokenized deposits or bank issued stablecoins, then the risk is that might lead to some fragmentation if there's significant functional differences between the way those things operate, and therefore whether it raises the specter of dangers and risks to the singleness of money, as the BIS state quite often in that respect.
I'm glad you mentioned stablecoins. We almost forgot about them in the race. I know Amalia has some questions moving in that direction.
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of stablecoins, there's been a couple of big ticket announcements semi-recently, with Ripple last week and then SocGen releasing their coin towards the end of last year. In terms of this sort of digital money race, what role do you see stablecoins playing? And do you think if they get powerful, I think the estimate was that they might reach $3 trillion in a couple of years, will that spook central banks to roll out CBDCs like quicker?
I'm not sure if spook is the right word, but it's certainly one of the major considerations. If you look at the consultative paper that the Bank of England issued on a UK stablecoin, CBDC, for instance, the potential risk associated with private forms of digital money having a systemic impact on the bank's ability to manage financial stability, monetary policy, etc. That's one of the key reasons, I think, for a CBDC to be considered. So it's definitely one of the reasons, you know, if the world is moving to a digital economy and the central banks in particular countries want to make sure that there's a central bank form of digital money available to feed and support that digital economy, and that it isn't completely dependent on privately issued stablecoins, which the bank may have less ability to control, then obviously that's one of the major considerations. I mean, we're way off $3 trillion worth of market cap at the moment. Obviously, I think the current stablecoin market cap is around 150 odd billion, but it's still a pretty big number. And, you know, there have been concerns in the past with some of the stablecoin issuers that have had a significant impact, you know, a part of their reserves held in commercial paper, for example, that if there was a run on a stablecoin, the impact that might have on, in that case, the CP market, for instance. So understanding where those systemic risks are is obviously quite a key consideration. So to your point, I think it is certainly one of the major reasons why a CBDC may be contemplated by central banks. And this is, by the way, one of the key focus areas that we have from a research point of view, this understanding of how the different forms of digital money will evolve. That's why we've launched, as Amelia knows, our Cambridge Digital Money Dashboard as a means of being able to plot the way these different forms of digital money will evolve.
Yeah, so people can see quite easily, really, like the volatility or the stability of these stable coins, like for the first time, really, and compare them. When you said that it will bring more choice, I thought that was really interesting. So like more choice can usually be a good thing, but does it bring more choice to just a few players, sort of creating like elite highways for very powerful, influential players to sort of interact and transact very efficiently, very cost effectively and very fast, and sort of lock others out? And I'm just thinking about these very powerful consortia led projects that we've got at the moment. So is it just choice for some, basically?
Yeah, I think we need to differentiate between the wholesale markets and the retail markets. So the consortia-based activity we're talking about, I guess, are mainly on the wholesale side. So you obviously talked about Project Agora from the BIS and seven central banks, et cetera, which is, you know, largely driven by the public sector, but obviously with active participation from the commercial banks that will be engaged in that project as well through the IIF in that sense. But also we have private sector initiatives like the Canton Network, for example, which recently, you know, announced their 45 firms with 22 decentralized apps running using digital assets technology to be able to facilitate that. So we have a combination of public and private kind of examples going on, and, you know, commercial banks involved in both, clearly. So you touched on a little earlier having fingers in multiple pies, and this is a good way of spreading one's bets, I think, to see exactly which is going to be the most successful. But on the retail side, you know, the world is a bit different in that case, because then the privately issued stablecoins have obviously been much more relevant in the retail consumer marketplace as increasingly as a means of payment. And that is a different kind of race, I think, with CBDCs, and to what extent we'll see bank deposits, tokenized bank deposits, playing a role as far as domestic payments are concerned, and potentially international payments as well.
Brilliant. And then, so in terms of the strongest horse in this digital money race, you mentioned tokenized deposits, and we've just talked about stable coins. And until we get to the wide or widespread use of CBDCs, who are the strongest horses that are springing up?
where should we put our money, so to speak?
Well, I think hedging is the most appropriate strategy at the moment, because it really is really too early to say, I think. I mean, a lot of the activities and initiatives we're talking about have really only come to the fore in the last year or two. We're still relatively early in the race. So, I mean, really hard to place bets, I think, in terms of what will be successful. But, you know, as I said, I think it's interesting to understand the public versus private kind of participants in these races. Obviously, the public sector, in terms of the central banks and BIS, have key relationships and responsibilities in terms of financial stability and monetary policy, etc., whereas the commercial banks have a direct interest in serving their customers most effectively, as well as being compliant with the necessary legal and regulatory obligations they're under. And then obviously the stablecoin issuers, the kind of fog is clearing, I guess, in terms of what the regulatory obligations are going to be. But in most cases, that those regulations aren't yet fully active. So exactly what impact that will have on stablecoins, we'll have a much better, clearer idea, I think, in the next 12 months when MiCA, the UK regulations, MAS, etc., have become implemented, and that will have a much clearer view in terms of where stablecoins sit from a payment mechanism point of view.
At the end of this, I'm going to try to get a date out of you, but I wanted to maybe go back a little bit to SWIFT, which is, you know, is one of the horses in this massive payments race. I mean, one of the people we quoted in the story last week on the site called SWIFT the dominant way to send money anywhere. However, it is very difficult, slow, and expensive. I mean, you could say yes to that, but do you think that's entirely fair to SWIFT? Trying to defend them slightly.
Not entirely in the sense of it's a question of what you're comparing it against. Mm. So, I mean, SWIFT, as we touched on earlier, has been hugely successful in terms of providing secure, effective payments messaging on a global basis with the thousands of banks that are members of it in that respect. You know, the world is changing, technology is changing, and, you know, I applaud SWIFT for being very proactive in terms of how they engage with those opportunities. And you touched on before the second phase of the work they've done with commercial banks and also central banks in terms of understanding how SWIFT can reinvent its role as a secure and effective facilitator of global payments through the various kind of pilots and POCs that they've been conducting with a range of topics from, as you know, facilitating trade, FX settlement, and also, you know, how to integrate and interoperate with CBDCs and also securities tokenization. So quite a wide range of different kind of use cases illustrating where the benefit of what SWIFT can bring sits against all the other alternatives. But, you know, there are other alternatives, and I think the way that plays out is going to be, you know, fascinating over the next year or two.
Mm. I'm interested in the drivers. I mean, it does seem like several of these horses are trading and sharing jockeys going back and forth. But it's like the person we also quoted in the article said central banks have all of a sudden become very aggressive. With looking at to enable payment rails and a lot of these developments, you know, what kickstarted this? Like, what's driving this aggressive behavior?
I think we can, in some respects, trace it all the way back to Libra and Diem, Facebook coin that was mooted, obviously, and that was a significant wake up call to central banks and to regulators around the world, and you know. That kind of kickstarted, I think, where the potential was for this, and that, you know, it had that come to pass, that would obviously had a significant bearing on what we're talking about here. And since then, obviously, central banks have rapidly advanced their thinking on CBDCs, and we have a number of them now in production with, you know, mixed success, I would say. But also we have, you know, a significant growth in stablecoin market cap and all the other new initiatives that are happening around tokenized deposits and so on. So I think central banks in particular obviously have mandates, as I touched on before, in terms of ensuring financial stability and implementing the monetary policy for their jurisdiction, and recognizing that all those environments that those mandates sit within are changing because of what we're talking about, be it stablecoins or other mechanisms that might exist. And in order to continue to play that mandate effectively, they really have to ensure that they can guide the development of what we're talking about in order to be able to continue to be able to effectively deliver on that mandate that they have as an obligation. And, you know, all credit to BIS in particular for leading much of the thinking and the facilitating the kind of pilots and projects we're talking about, not just with other central banks, but with the commercial banking sector and also fintech. So a lot of the technologies being used in, you know, the regulated liability network, in BIS's own pilots, a lot of this is coming from fintechs that are collaborating with both central banks and commercial banks along these lines.
That was another question I had. I'm sorry to bring in that when the BIS said this will be a private sector partnership, they mean fintech companies, correct?
Well, private sector and also fintech companies and also commercial banks, of course. So they're, you know, they will come in on the paying and receiving, you know, pay and payor end of the transactions, I'm sure, across a variety of use cases. I mean, we're just speculating in terms of what Agora will actually get into. But I'm assuming that it'll be, you know, certainly commercial banks from the private sector and some technologies. And obviously, you know, both CBDC and RLN pilots that have taken place have collaborated with a, you know, significant number of fintechs that are providing the underlying technology as well. Mm.
It's so funny. Facebook's Libra, the failed currency that started a revolution.
I mean, would you say that spooked them? I think spook would be quite appropriate for that.
Oh, it's that spook would be more relevant there. That's certainly true, I think. Now I think everybody is fully woken up, drunk their coffee, and is working out very sanely and sensibly what the next step should be.
All right. So I have the right. For the last few years, there's been a panel on some of these conferences around the world, which says, are CBDCs the answer to solve the cross-border payments problem? And I wrote down in my notes 2023, this year, hey. But I meant, I'm looking for a date. I've heard the date 2030 is when we will see CBDCs for cross-border payments. Get on the record, Keith. What is your prediction? When do you think we'll see them?
I hesitate greatly to give a prediction because we're still in the process of researching, and as you might imagine from the university research center point of view, we're focused on empirical evidence, so that you know, we're keen to understand where the paths might be to that rather than trying to put a specific date in it, which would be really difficult. However, you know, the Bank of England has said that if a CBDC is implemented in the UK, then it'll be around the 2030 timescale. Though to be fair, the focus is more on domestic use rather than international payments at the moment. And obviously the digital euro might, if approved, also come in before, on or before that date as well. So I think we may, if the decisions are made to implement CBDCs from these major economies, the EU, the UK, maybe others as well, then CBDCs will potentially have a bigger role to play as far as central bank issued digital money. And that itself might also lead to more advancing of the whole debate about how CBDCs can be used for cross-border payments as well. So, you know, to answer your question, partly at least, I think, you know, the pointers are heading in that kind of direction, if only because that retail CBDCs will be, if decisions are made to implement, then that's the kind of timescale that's being mooted by those central banks that I mentioned.
Wonderful. Thank you, Keith. I really appreciate you calling this a very interesting question that we don't know the answer for yet. But when we do, we'll have you back to talk about the different phases of the global payments race we're going in now. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Banker Exchange, part of the portfolio of podcasts from the editorial team at The Banker, available on thebanker.com and wherever you get your podcast fix. Search on The Banker Podcasts to listen to more.